Hello, and welcome to the Television Spotlight on the Comic Book Cage podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be having a spoiler-filled discussion about a television show that we think you'll enjoy. I am joined by my sister Kay. We have just finished watching Doctor Who, the TV movie that was done on Fox in 1996.
So it was mostly an American production, is what you're telling me.
It was for the American audience, but it was done actually up in Canada.
Interesting.
I believe it may be one of the only things for Doctor Who done in Canada, actually. It was a couple of years, I think about 7 years after the original Doctor Who series had gone off the air. And about a decade before it was picked up again for the current kind of stuff.
BBC affiliated but not driven is what it sounds like.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was in partnership with, and they may have been hoping to revise the franchise, but it was not their production.
The only reason I'm asking is, okay, I'm not a Doctor Who fan, watcher, etc. I think I've seen one episode to completion, but I've flipped by it occasionally over the decades and seen bits. To me, this was a more straightforward, easy to follow, less wacky show than what I think of Doctor Who as being.
I think your passing familiarity is based on the original series.
Probably.
My familiarity with it is based on the series after this. I had never really watched any Doctor Who, had a coworker that was a huge Doctor Who fan. And when they had announced they were starting the series back up, it was clear to me that I was going to be hearing about every episode in excruciating detail, so I might as well watch it and enjoy the show. This is kind of the point, the thing I suggest people start with if they're new to Doctor Who. One, because I'm just not familiar with the older stuff. And two, I think it's got kind of like the original series Trek feels a little dated versus Next Generation. And to me, this is not quite that Next Generation starting point, because I would say that would be the new Doctor Who series. But for a 86-minute TV movie, you get an additional Doctor.
For me, this was a nice introduction to a lot of the, what is the universe of Doctor Who in terms of, okay, what's the TARDIS, what's the Sonic Screwdriver?
The basic concepts, yeah.
Yeah. So, and it was all self-contained.
And that's the other reason. In 86 minutes, you get the entire, virtually the entire arc of the this Doctor.
Yeah. So all of that was just a great introduce me to the world or the universe and give me the basic concepts. It didn't give all that much of a why the Doctor goes wandering, but I didn't expect that out of it. I think that's about the only other thing they could have thrown in that would have been nice to have.
They've been working on that for 50 years, and I don't know that they've answered that totally.
Okay.
He just, you got to take certain parts of it as he does that. And the nice thing is it makes it a fairly low intimidation entry point.
Yeah.
There are aspects of this where it's in continuity. We get Sylvester McCoy as the seventh Doctor at the beginning of this. We see how he dies, how he regenerates into the Paul McGann Doctor, the eighth Doctor. So it's got that aspect, which I find kind of fascinating in this day and age where everything is continually getting rebooted, retooled, and whatnot. For them to have continued that that timeline, I think, was a brilliant move in terms of just how it's panned out. And when they started the TV show with Eccleston, he had just presumably regenerated because he makes a comment of not having seen his features before.
Mm, nice.
But they didn't show who he had regenerated from. So they had the opportunity, if they had wanted to insert Doctors between McGann and Eccleston, or just disavow McGann entirely.
Yeah.
Now, when it came time for the 50th anniversary, they deal with that kind of stuff. But what I like about this is, while it's atypical because it's a North American production versus a BBC production, it's a TV movie versus episodic TV, it gets enough of the concepts across.
It does. It's very human-based. It's very earth-based. Mm-hmm. But it gives you some of the space aspects. It gives you some of the alien aspects. But it doesn't dwell on any of that to the point that you feel like, oh my God, I don't know what all this jargon is.
You've got a context from which to enjoy the series from, because it's enough familiarity. And that's it. It's got all of the hallmarks of, I don't say classic Doctor Who, but iconic Doctor Who, I think is the term I want to use. You've got the Doctor.
I was going to question your statement, but keep going.
You've got the companions. You've got the TARDIS. You've got the sonic screwdriver. You've got all of the things, even though those things evolve over the years. It's kind of like if you're doing a Batman thing. Mm-hmm. Batman, Alfred, the Commissioner, the Batmobile, the Batarang, a couple of things like that.
I'll agree that two characters felt like companions, but they don't travel in the TARDIS with him, except for one brief moment.
Fair point. As far as this movie goes, one could argue they technically do not fall into the companion category because they don't go and have an adventure. They're just locals he had an adventure with. However, there was a series, as far as I understand, I haven't actually listened to any of these, audio dramas done by this cast afterwards.
Oh, interesting.
That essentially promotes them to that status.
That is interesting, because I thought they would make very good companions.
I'm actually impressed that you understand that that's part of the definition of the companion.
Thank John Barrowman and his panels.
Yes. Well, and that's one of the joys of the first series of the rebooted series or restarted series is John Barrowman is in that as Captain Jack. And that the Eccleston series is the other obvious starting point. But again, it seemed like, you know, you roll back an hour and a half, you get another Doctor, what the heck?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think there's payoff for that a little down the line.
I really liked the characters in this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, starting with the obvious, I thought the Doctor was well done and a good character. He was just wacky enough to be enjoyable. He didn't come across as crazy. He came across as a little eccentric.
And that is one of the things I enjoy about Doctor Who. Again, not really having dealt with the first seven Doctors much.
Mm-hmm.
A little here and there. I think a good Doctor is one that eccentric is the right description of. He's a little different than the rest of us, but not so different that you just can't stand to be around him.
Yeah.
He's clearly operating on a different wavelength, arguably at a higher level, sometimes maybe not so much. But this one had... The thing that was different about this Doctor was he seemed to have some kind of insight into people's timelines.
And that's why I'm curious about how that works, how that understanding is.
I take it as being unique to that Doctor. I don't recall it. It's not in any of the later ones.
Interesting.
And I don't recall it from any of the earlier ones, but again, I am not an expert on those.
Mm-hmm. I really thought the character that had the best arc was Lee. Just in terms of when we first meet him, he's little more than a street punk who needs to get his life together.
He's a street punk in a bad place, but he also helps the Doctor out.
He does, and that's the first sign he's got potential.
I guess to me, he's a character on the fence and could go either way and benefits from the Doctor's intervention.
Mm-hmm. But he really has the potential to fall to the wrong side because of who he gets caught up with.
Absolutely, and I think good companions fall into that category. One of the categories is those that without the Doctor would have either led a really boring, unfulfilling life or gone down a really bad path.
Yeah,
he could have gone down a bad path very easily.
Yeah. Well, and in terms of if the TARDIS had never arrived.
Well, he'd have died.
Or in terms of if the Doctor had not made the efforts he made.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, Lee was a really good and rewarding arc. The Doctor, in terms of Grace, she was a very consistent, true-to-herself character.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that.
So while I enjoyed everything she did, it wasn't as interesting to watch because she wasn't surprising me. I wasn't rooting for her in the same way that I was rooting for Lee to figure things out, to smarten up. To fall back towards that side that prompted him to help the guy that saved his life.
Well, and I would be hard-pressed to name a defining characteristic of Grace. She's a doctor, but mm-hmm. that's her profession.
Yeah.
Whereas I look at some of the later companions, And I can, they've got a particular aspect about them that's kind of a defining personality trait, not the only one.
We see hints that Grace is caring and compassionate, mm-hmm. but it's not in that overriding manner. Not like she's driven by being caring or driven by being compassionate to be a doctor.
Yeah, we don't know if she became... Well, we're told one of the reasons she became a doctor is to hold back death.
Mm-hmm.
But is that out of a sense of arrogance, of compassion, out of loss? And again, they had one TV movie. They didn't have time to develop the character further.
Yeah.
But again, maybe in the audiobooks, audio dramas, maybe they did.
I was torn at the end about whether or not I wanted her to go with him. Because if she went with him, it felt very much like and I want them to continue a romantic relationship. But I'm not sure that's what I want for the doctor.
It's funny, it's been a while since I've seen this. I think I saw it when it originally aired.
Okay.
And I was expecting at the end, TARDIS goes off. She turns, or she starts to regret having made the decision to not go. TARDIS comes back. He's got, and another thing, kind of a, and then she comes, at which point the other guy comes back too.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go off and have adventures.
Yeah.
And I think if it had looked like they were going to get a series, if anything, you know, if everything had looked like it really been gelling or something, maybe that would have been either the thing they add to the end of this or would have been the start of the next episode.
Mm-hmm.
As it was, just having, you know, doing it as a one-off feature, you know, I felt changed the dynamic a bit. You know, this is the only doctor, I think, to not deal with, like, the Daleks, the Cybermen, some of the other classic villains. But he deals with the Master. I thought the fate of the Master at the end was a bit ambiguous.
Mm.
But that's also, again, that's kind of like the Joker to the Doctor being Batman. Kind of, you know, the yin-yang, the arch-enemy kind of a deal.
Yeah. I thought he was well cast. I like Eric Roberts when he does the stereotypical bad guy thing. Mm-hmm.
One thing with Grace that did bother me a little is when she sees the motorcycle cop drive into this tiny little phone booth-sized thing and then eventually drive out and goes in. And it's bigger on the inside. She has no reason to be expecting this or for that not to,
to it even doesn't
register with a comment.
Yeah, it doesn't faze her in the slightest. She seems to have gotten very accustomed to everything around the doctor is strange and not what she expects. So I was expecting a comment there.
Well, and in the later series, the it's bigger on the inside, you know, kind of reaction is almost one of the, I don't say cliche moments, but checkoff points for a new companion.
Yeah.
And we did get that with, I'm blanking on the...
Lee. Yeah.
Blanking on his name. Because he walks back out, walks around the thing.
Yeah, that was nice.
Hanging onto it the whole time to make sure it's solid.
Yeah.
You know, so it shows he's got some brains and stuff.
I liked the key for it. I thought that was a cute little knick-knack.
It was. The key is something that, again, is routinely referenced and used in the subsequent series as almost a rite of passage.
Mm.
You know, you're going to stay with me, you know, here's a key to the TARDIS.
Yeah.
You know, the doctor accepting the companion almost. And it's usually a more standard key than this version here.
I liked this one because it reminded me of a constellation.
A constellation and also just a little bit alien.
Yeah.
I mean, the concept of the key may be universal, but I wouldn't expect extraterrestrials to have what we... you go back 200 years, we don't even have what we think of as a key.
Yeah.
It's a different shape, a different style. It doesn't have the Templar locks, you know, that kind of a thing.
A almost 80-year-old complained to me recently that they were afraid they would not be able to check into a hotel and stay there because they had gotten an email from the hotel people saying that they were now issuing digital keys on smartphones. And this senior citizen does not have a smartphone, so they were afraid the hotel was no longer issuing keys when you registered.
Yeah. Again, times change.
Keys change.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that was one of those conversations where you have to, you know, stop and think through how does this come across to someone else?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, explain to them digital key is not the only way the lock works.
Well, in Yeah, it's just everybody brings their own baggage, and I think it's a generational thing. The definition of what a key is and can be has changed.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's funny because I don't know in the Doctor Who stuff I've watched that they've ever truly played with that aspect of time travel. That this, you could say the same thing to somebody in different eras, and it means something completely different. Or to get the same concept across, you've got to use radically different terms.
Yeah, well, regionally within our own country, you know, in some parts of the U.S., you'll say, I'm going to give someone a ride. And other parts of the U.S., you'll say, I'm going to carry someone.
I guess to me, that's regional dialect versus evolution of language. But it's an offshoot of that. It's similar concept, certainly.
But again, it's one of those things where you have to stop and kind of parse out. If you're used to one expression, you have to parse out what the other one means, and does it mean the same thing?
Mm-hmm. Well, and one of the things, just in terms of how a lapse of time changes one's perspective, one of the comments you made was how this was shot in 1996, but took place in 1999, end of the year, with end of year, you know, parties of, hey, 2000 is here. And you mentioned there was no reference of Y2K at all.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, it didn't exist back then.
Yeah. Well, and the reason I mentioned it was because it felt like people dreaded and talked about Y2K forever. There was such a buildup to the fear of Y2K.
But at this point, 4 years or so prior, the concept of we're using 2 years to store a four-year date hadn't permeated down to the writing staffs of television and movies for that to even be a thing. Whereas I'm willing to bet 2-3 years later, there was all sorts of awareness and fear and paranoia. It's just...
Yeah. Well, I guess the thing to me is because it felt like it was a fear for so long, the fact that 4 years earlier it was unheard of, it hadn't registered with me. Because it felt like 4 years worth of fear to me.
For any listeners that are young enough to not know what Y2K is, because we're far enough along that we could have listeners that young.
Yeah, if you're 20 years old, so you don't remember what was going on when you were 4 years old.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Basically, at the time, when computers originated, space was at a premium. Okay, so to store a date, you wanted to use as few characters or bytes as possible. And you could do it with two digits in just the last two digits. And, you know, when you're dealing in 1969, 1970, 1985, everything's going to just, the 19 is assumed.
Yeah.
But then once you realize, wait a sec, we're going to hit a point where it's going to be 2000 and the 20 needs to be assumed versus the 19. Well, the first solution was just to have a cutoff date. Anything prior to 50 we'll assume is going to be 2000. Anything after we'll assume is the 1900s or whatever. But it got to the point where space was not at such a premium, and it made sense to actually store the actual four-digit value. And yes, you could use integers, you could use all sorts of different computer storage. I'm just trying to simplify the concept. But the problem was not all software was written with that rollover in mind, because some of these systems, it's surprising how long a computer system can last software-wise, even if the hardware changes a number of times.
Very true.
And the fear was, you know, when everything went from 99 to zero, it's like, well, suddenly you're now back in time. It doesn't work. It's not like it can do the math and say it's a year later, a day later, whatever. It's amazing how big of a deal that one assumption, how big of a ramification that can have when it's baked into software.
Yeah. People were afraid that bank computer systems would crash and
couldn't calculate interest. His interest is based on the number of days elapsed. And suddenly, as far as the computer's concerned, you're a century earlier.
Yeah.
You know,
when we first started using computers, a file name was 8 letters.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had to think really hard on what cryptic 8 letters you were going to use for your English papers or whatever, because you only had those limited number.
And those are the sorts of things where the time frame you are in, you are born in, et cetera, radically impacts how you think of things.
Yeah.
And again, that's the kind of idea I think would be fun for an episode of Doctor Who. And I don't know what concept would be the right one, but I could definitely see an episode in which he is essentially bouncing forward 25, 100 years, whatever, to steer society and how they think about an idea.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you can't change certain things overnight. But if you've got a time machine, you've got hundreds of years to do it over.
Yeah.
You know, plant the idea as fiction, then do this, then do that, you know, whatever. This TARDIS looked a bit different on the inside than other doctors, but that's kind of standard. They've since referred to that as changing the desktop theme.
That's funny.
What got me with this is the door on the outside and the door on the inside didn't seem to match. Whereas with the new series, they tend to be pretty good about...
Oh, a single door became a double door.
The portal matching on both sides.
Yeah.
And also, this seemed to be a much more expansive main room with the TARDIS console and such, and the reading chair and all of these other things.
I will admit it tickled my funny bone that at the beginning he sat down to read a book, and at the end he went back to find what page he'd been on. And
sat down to read the same book, yeah.
Yeah.
But if you think about it, a lot of this movie takes place in that main console room and in the Eye of Harmony room.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really all we see of the TARDIS by and large.
Now, the Eye of Harmony room kind of amused me because in some respects it reminded me of, I want to say, the ruins of some like Gothic church in England.
Mm-hmm.
In its grandiose style, but it had leaves blowing around in it.
Well, and bats flying around. There was an aspect of it was archaic, but like it belonged on a planet, not in a vehicle.
Yeah.
But that in the main TARDIS room were really the only two standing sets they had to build.
Mm.
Everything else was either on location in the alleyway, in the hospital, or at Grace's place, or at the time, the Technology Institute.
Yeah.
So a lot of it was location shooting. And that gave them a little bit more time and freedom to presumably build up nicer sets. Whereas when you're doing the TV show on I don't say a weekly basis, because they do a series at a time, you don't need or necessarily want to allocate as much of your studio space to kind of the main TARDIS room. But it's also the showcase set for the show.
I liked the view above. Of the solar system and space.
Kind of the projection holographic thing, yeah.
Yeah, I thought that was nicely done.
That, I don't think, ever gets used later.
Hmm.
But again, it's hard to tell. I don't know if it was used prior, actually. And it may have been used later, I don't recall. It's hard to know how much of that was just preference of the doctor at that time versus, you know, later or whatever.
Yeah.
I think McGann did a good job as the doctor.
Yeah.
The way he chose his attire was as much based on what was available as anything else. But that's also one of the, I don't say coming of ages, but checkpoints for the doctor.
He bypassed the scarf.
Well, there's usually in the wardrobe scene some reference or visual Easter egg to previous doctors.
I figured.
And in a couple of cases, it's a little bit of a I don't say prolonged scene, but some doctors give a lot more thought as to what they wear.
Yeah.
And some of them have a lot more choice based on are they doing it in the TARDIS, where they've got an infinite wardrobe effectively, or are they doing it kind of like this guy was doing it at a hospital and grabbing what you can.
Yeah.
But that was something that I thought was some fun scenes with particularly the Matt Smith doctor. Because it was another one where it was kind of on the go. And I'm trying to remember both Capaldi's and Tennant's, whereas Eccleston just kind of shows up with his look. But having a signature look for the Doctor is important and easy to do when you have one TV movie.
Yes.
Trying to think if there are any kind of hallmarks of the series that this was lacking. Obviously, we don't get all the different villains and stuff like I mentioned earlier, but again, there wasn't the time or the need. You've got one adventure you're doing.
We saw the TARDIS in motion. We saw the TARDIS land twice.
Yeah. We see the Sonic, although he doesn't really use it. We see Gallifreyan attire with what the Master's wearing at the end.
Mm, yeah.
So they cover quite a bit of stuff.
Yeah.
I don't recall who wrote this, but one of the things that does stand out in the series afterwards is just they've had some top-notch writers. Russell T. Davies, Stephen Moffat, a number of other people connected to it and who've written some episodes are just well-known for being kind of top of their craft over, particularly in the UK. But again, this is one of the, I'm going to say, three big British franchises.
Mm.
You got, in no particular order, Doctor Who, James Bond, Sherlock Holmes. Don't know if Harry Potter would count or not.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there's a very clear kind of go-to checklist of major properties. And, of course, Doctor Who, long tenure and stuff. This was an attempt to bring it back, an attempt to get it to a more North American audience.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it had been on PBS and stuff quite a bit, and then later BBC America on the episodic side. And I think as our culture got more into sci-fi and as geek culture got more accepted, that's what's led to the rise of the popularity of the character.
I can see that.
So, now this has been one that I've been wanting to do with you for a while, just to kind of introduce you to the character.
Mm-hmm.
There were a few aspects here where, because it was more TV movie, it was a bit more cinematic in approach. The whole bit with the operating room and a few things like that.
Oh, yeah, I can see that.
You know, one thing that is a hallmark, at least of later Who, I don't know about original, but when he was telling Grace to run, to get back to the main room or whatever, there's a certain aspect of, if you're going to be a doctor or a companion, you've got to be in good shape.
You know, what I liked about that scene is she comments to him something to the effect of, you know, if I do this, you're going to die.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, yeah, but everyone else will live.
Yeah, if you don't, everybody dies.
Yeah. And that was a trait to the character I really like.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's, again, the personality of the Doctor changes from generation to regeneration. But there are certain aspects of he is who he is, even if he doesn't always remember it.
Yeah.
Going back to the running bit, though, one of the things I did love at one of the conventions we went to with Matt Smith,
yeah,
was somebody asked a question of can I run with you? And at first, Matt Smith is like, I don't get it. And then it clicks. Ah, got it. And then they go from one side of the stage to the other. You know, yeah. And Smith did a great job of just, you know, you gotta know how to do this, because it's like fighting on screen.
Oh, yes.
There's an art to it.
Yeah.
You know, you don't just run all out, because you're going to have to do this a number of times. And you got to watch how you start and you stop.
Mm.
You know, so you don't, you know, stop on a dime and, you know, try to kill yourself or something. But that was something that this had in it, and not in any sort of a forced way. It was just an integral part of the story, and it worked.
Yeah.
So from my vantage point, this is not like one of the high points of the Doctor Who franchise. It's just an interesting kind of, I don't say abnormality or anomaly, but period of it.
I think it's a nice, low-key introduction to the franchise for me.
Yeah. It's a low intimidation approach.
Yeah.
And again, that's part of why it's like, you know, hey, hour and a half, I think anyone can, yeah, even if it sucks, I think you can sit through it kind of a deal.
Yeah, it's not jargon heavy at all.
Nope.
It's not concept heavy at all, honestly, in terms of they give you the basics, but they don't weigh you down with the universe.
Well, and it's got a beginning, a middle, and an end in an hour and a half.
Yeah.
It's not, ooh, we're going to start this major arc that'll go for seasons or something. It's like, no, we're telling a story, we're getting out.
Yeah.
I think, again, had this more time, I think the Paul McGann Eighth Doctor would have solidified more personality, more traits. Same with the companions and such. But it didn't have the chance. And this was a oasis during a drought for the franchise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was, again, 7 years before and about 10 years after, before any other live-action Doctor Who.
Yeah.
So, again, I enjoyed it. I thought it was good. It's available on DVD. It is not available on Blu-ray. I think that goes down to it's not a BBC production, therefore they can't get it out there. Fox really doesn't have any incentive.
Well, and it could also be the frame size. They may not see the point. And the effects, they'd have to boost them up. It may cost, in other words, to put to Blu-ray.
True, True. Could be, but you would think even during the 50th anniversary, they didn't bother. And that would have been the time to do it.
Yeah. And
there's no incentive is what it comes down to.
Yeah. And Netflix lists seasons, but this wouldn't be listed under a season. So I don't think it's on Netflix.
It may not be. I don't know. And the whole season thing with Doctor Who gets a little confusing because there was 26 seasons originally, I believe. And then it stopped. You get the TV movie. And then technically what comes after it is series one, series two, but not season.
Yeah, but I think because Netflix is a U.S. company, they refer to the series as seasons.
And I was going by what's on like Wikipedia and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Because I think I'd like us to do episodes on the following stuff. I think season by season makes sense. My plan is to refer to it as series one, series two, and then put which actor is the doctor.
Yeah.
As in that, in the episode title, just so people know. But then you've got one of Eccleston, three with Tennant, followed by a series four, bunch of 2-hour movie special type things. Then you've got three with Matt Smith, two with Capaldi. And at the end of the Smith stuff, there's the 50th anniversary stuff.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's plenty of material. Each of these seasons or series, take your pick, go for 13 episodes of about 45 minutes or so each that are either done in one or done in two stories for the most part. And then there's a Christmas special.
Yeah.
So if you're new to Doctor Who, again, Eighth Doctor with the TV movie, I think is a good starting point. If you love it, keep going. If you hate it, it is a little bit different than the ongoing TV show. I think the TV show, a decade later, ups the production values and takes a bit more of a TV approach to it.
Well, and I think if you're neutral on it, my reaction to this was this is much more, I don't want to say by the numbers, but it feels much more like your typical movie of the week than I feel Doctor Who normally is.
Well, it's because it is exactly what it was.
Yeah.
This was the period of time where Fox was doing not only just this, but the David Hasselhoff, Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., a Generation Next TV movie based on kind of the young X-Men characters, not like Beast or whatever, but Jubilee and a few others, and a few other things that were literally just the movie of the week type things.
Yeah. So I really think they tried to take Doctor Who and tone it down and mainstream it a bit from what I think Doctor Who, like the one episode you've shown me from the current runs, the one that had Ben Browder.
For accessibility here.
Yes, yes.
Whereas the one I showed you with Ben Browder, because I knew you were familiar with the actor from both Farscape and Stargate. That was one that was very much in the middle of a season, and they kind of expect you to just know all the characters already.
Well, but also there's just, this is, if I were going to make a scale of a 0 to 100% accessibility, I would put this at 95 to 100% accessibility for Joe Blow viewer, whether they like sci-fi or not.
Well, and what I would follow that up with is any TV series season, you're going to have a certain accessibility at the start of the season, and it's going to drop as you go down just because they figured you've watched the previous couple of episodes.
Definitely. But my normal impression of Doctor Who is that even if I watch the first episode of the season, it's much more sci-fi heavy than this is, and it's much more off on other planets, and it's much more time travel oriented with different periods. This was all basically, you feel comfortable in your normal environment.
It was all contemporary time
everything.
Frame. Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
The lack of any alien planet, different time period, different culture, certainly ups the accessibility of it. And that is something with the other things we're planning on doing episodes on. There will be some of that. What I will say is Russell T. Davies, who was the lead writer and showrunner when they brought the series back in 2006-ish, brilliant writer.
Oh, and I'm expecting all the others to be in the high 80%.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying that I think this is more mainstream. than the others because they went so high accessibility and relatability.
Absolutely, and particularly after a 7-year gap of the character being out there, targeting it to a different audience. Yes, I completely agree. Yeah. And again, those are parts of the reasons I thought this was a good place to start.
Yeah, and I agree with that.
So, like I said, if you're new to Doctor Who, I think this is worth checking out. If you're familiar, if you've been watching the BBC series but have not seen this, I recommend checking it out. It sheds a little bit of light on one of the, I guess technically it was a webisode they did around the 50th anniversary. And it's just, again, gives you another Doctor for about an hour and a half of your time.
Yeah, it was fun.
So anything else?
I think you're good.
Cool.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.